From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. With Sunday's earthquake in California, rivers of wine splashed across the floors of Napa Valley cellars. With the big drought in the West, winemakers are wringing their hands over next year's harvest. But drought and quake are not the whole story of Napa wine, California wine, American wine. There's climate change, craft beer, the China market roaring up, and Americans' wine habits changing. This hour on Point, drought, quake, and American wine. These are actually pretty good times. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you cringe when you saw all those broken barrels and bottles after the quake in Napa? How does wine fit into your world these days? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. 6.0 quake in California centered in Napa, and some people took it pretty hard. Here on Monday, speaking with local San Francisco CBS affiliate KPIX, John Rule, president of the Napa Valley-based Trefethen Family Vineyards, said his winery, built in 1886, twisted in the earthquake and was red tagged as too dangerous to even enter.
It was heartbreaking. It was really, really a sad moment. And at the time, I think we're still in shock. It just did not feel real.
Heartbreaking, still in shock at Silver Oak Vineyards. Here's David Duncan, president there, said he only lost 3 barrels in the earthquake that rocked the region. But 3 barrels of top quality vintage meant pretty big money. Here he is with CBS reporter Carter Evans.
Each of these barrels holds 25 cases of wine, and you're at $1,300 a case. $100,000 worth of wine here.
Just in the 3 barrels.
And talking with AP on Tuesday, Napa Valley-based Saintsbury Winery co-founder David Graves said the earthquake shattered bottles of his vintage wines because of the way they were stored.
Those are stored up. Some of them are like 15 feet off the ground, so if they shake loose, they have a long ways to fall before they break. And there were a lot of broken bottles.
We're looking at quake, drought, and American wine this hour. With us first from Pacific Grove, California, is John Bonet, wine editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, author of The New California Wine. He was watching up close as the earthquake reports poured in from Napa last weekend. John Bonet, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Good to be here.
Who got, first on the quake front, who got hit worst in the quake, John? We've seen photographs of just piles of barrels busted up and all over the floor.
Absolutely. We're still trying to figure that out, and I suspect a lot of wineries are still trying to figure that out because they're still digging through their barrels. It's going to take some time. Obviously, Trefethen, as you mentioned, less their wine than the historic winery building there that shifted about 4 feet, and you could just sort of see it leaning precariously.
Ouch.
I think ultimately what we're going to discover, there were a few larger wineries that lost a good bit of wine. Sebastiani, I think, lost something several million bottles worth, but it's not that expensive. It's not sort of Silver Oak expensive, as
yep.
David was explaining. But I think in general, the folks who are at least going to be hardest hit by this are the small wineries, in part because, especially in Napa, because of the way that the county regulations work, it's very difficult for a small winery to actually have its own cellar. So a lot of these folks who are either trying to get started or, you know, who just don't make that much wine, although it may be very expensive, they have to use essentially rented space. And so one of the things we're discovering is that a number of these spots that are often called custom crush facilities were really adversely impacted. And so it's not just that, you know, everyone's barrels came down. It's that it's a lot of different people's barrels. They're going to be sorting it out. They've got to figure out whose wine went where. And it's one thing, you know, if you make 50,000, 100,000 cases of wine. If you make 2,000, 3,000 cases of wine, you're doing it in someone else's facility, and it's been thrown together like it was on a roller coaster, you're going to be struggling for a while.
John, when a quake comes, and this one came right to Napa, I mean, kind of spot on here, what's most vulnerable? Is it bottles? Is it those big wooden wine barrels? Is it the big crushing fermentation tanks?
Probably has more than anything to do with what seismic precautions people took beforehand. I think the barrels got the worst of it, and some of that is simply that, and especially, again, in these facilities where it's not entirely a free-for-all, but it's a little bit laissez-faire at times. The you know, there's just, people have sort of standard barrel racking. You know, you put them on steel racks and you stack them four or five high. And frankly, it's probably not the wisest thing to do in earthquake country. And so in talking to a number of vintners this week, it's been interesting who really spent time thinking about how to sort of lock their barrels down in case there was a seismic event. Bottles, you know, was really a question of, one, were they in cases? Two, how were they stored? So there's a lot of warehouses in southern Napa, which are almost literally on top of where the epicenter was, that store millions and millions of cases of wine. And in general, most of them seem to have been fine because they put the cases on pallets, mm-hmm. they shrink wrap them down, and they really don't give them anywhere to move. And so it's more kind of like the folks at Sainsbury were explaining, you know, if you have bottles kind of either loose or in an open case stuck high up, that's gonna tumble immediately, especially depending on the how it was aligned with the direction of the earthquake. So I think one of the things people are going to be looking at is whether it's stacking barrels, whether it's library wines, what have you, how do you really start rebuilding your storage in a way that keeps these things secure when an earthquake of this magnitude or potentially even greater come along?
I'm reading here in the Wine Spectator about vintners walking knee-deep in glass, calling it just a disaster, at the Hess Collection on Mount Veeder. Describing two 10,000-gallon tanks ruptured and leaked almost 15,000 cases worth of 2013, this is vintage Cabernet Sauvignon, into the surrounding meadow and courtyard, dyeing the grass purple. I mean, where it hit hard, it really hurts. But I guess there's a blessing here, if we can call it that, John, that most of the wine, if you want to put it that way, is still on the vine. The grapes are not yet harvested.
Yeah, harvest is just beginning. It's actually a little early this year. For a lot of folks, including Sainsbury, they actually happen to be in a really fortunate spot. Not that it's ever fortunate, mm-hmm. but a lot of their barrels toppled over, but they were empty because they were just starting to pick grapes and crush them. And so, if anything, people are going to be a little delayed because, you know, they're just a bit busy right now,
yeah.
Cleaning up. But you know, if this had come probably 3 weeks later, it could have been much, much worse.
When things were in more bottles and vats, when does the Napa harvest start in earnest?
It's really starting right now. I mean, now through October, basically. Essentially, again, we're a little early, so I'm going to say the month of September and into early October is really going to be kind of the big time there. But there were already folks starting when this hit.
Is it machine-picked these days, hand-picked, both, what?
In Napa, Napa obviously has done very well in the wine industry. It's almost entirely handpicked.
Wow. Let's talk about drought for a second,
yeah.
Because we've all heard so much about California's drought and the warnings. How does that play into the wine business and the vineyards? Are they hit by that? Are they okay?
Luckily for wine lovers, wine and wine grapes are really one of the few crops that are relatively drought tolerant. It doesn't frankly take a whole lot of water to grow wine grapes unless you're growing in, you know, at this very industrial scale, like out in the Central Valley. So, you know, I think the folks who were worried about drought, I mean, who really, really were worried about water, either, you know, reduced their crop load or decided in some cases in some vineyards, you know, lesser quality vineyards to just sit this year out knowing that we weren't going to get water. But it's actually otherwise been a pretty good year in terms of the crop. It's going to be smaller, and it's not just the drought this year, but this is our third harvest, our third vintage with drought, and so the vines are just frankly getting a little bit tapped out, so they didn't 2012, 2013 were very, very big harvests for California, and so 2014 is probably going to be a little bit smaller, but one of the things with the drought year is what you might lose in quantity, you actually tend to gain in quality. So, in fact,
Because of the concentrated flavor and that,
exactly.
In the drier grape?
Yeah, I mean, it's the simplest of equations. If there's less water in the grape, then there's more flavor in it, essentially. So there's a few folks who've been a little concerned about drought and about water access. Some of the winery reservoirs are a little low. But, you know, in general, compared to the other crops in California, the wine industry has had relatively few concerns.
You talked about smaller wineries. What does that mean in Napa Valley these days? What's a small winery? I have no idea what that means in acres.
it's in the eye of the beholder, I suspect. And it's not even acres, because there's so many folks who don't actually own their own vineyards. They have to buy fruit. You know, I would personally classify a small winery as maybe under certainly 5,000 cases and maybe 10,000 cases of wine. The industry may have other definitions, but, you know, that's mostly if you're putting it up against the really big wineries, which are 200, 500, a million cases of wine. So, you know, the thing is, again, when you're making something like high-end Cabernet, 2,000, 3,000 cases of wine, if it's $150, $200 a bottle, is still a pretty decent-sized business.
So it sounds like the message out of Napa, and we're going to look more broadly here around California, the country, the world, but the message out of Napa, yes, a lot of shattered bottles and busted up barrels, but you're still going to see a pretty decent harvest and times not too bad for the wine business.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's some folks who probably have some significant business concerns. They're trying to figure out where they're going to harvest this year's grapes, because not only do they have to clean up where they were working, but there's not necessarily a place for them to have a fermentation tank or to crush the grapes. So I think the winemakers in Napa are really trying to sort of pool resources and see who has, you know, is there an extra tank here? Is there a little bit of space there just to get through the harvest? But I think in general, it's going to be relatively fine, and the overall scope of the amount of wine that's produced, this is still pretty small.
John Bonnet is editor for wine at the San Francisco Chronicle, joined us from Pacific Grove, California. John, thanks very much.
Hey, my pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about California drought, Napa earthquake, and American wine, the big picture on wine in this country and beyond. And of course, wine goes far beyond California in the United States these days, and of course, much wider in the world, with new players as well. China coming in as a huge market, but also as a very big producer. We'll hear in just a moment from Antonio Galloni, a big American wine critic who's tasting right now in Italy and about to check in with us on Wines American and Beyond. We'll hear in this hour from former NFL quarterback Drew Bledsoe, played for the New England Patriots, the Buffalo Bills, the Dallas Cowboys. Now he's a vintner in Washington State. With us right now from Tacoma, Washington, is Mike Vieseth. He's editor of the online journal The Wine Economist, professor emeritus of international political economy at the University of Puget Sound, author of The Wine Wars and Extreme Wine. Mike Vieseth, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Tom.
All right. You're the big wine economist. Do you worry about drought and earthquake knocking the legs from under this business, this industry, or is it much bigger than that zone?
Oh, I worry about drought and earthquake. And drought, not just in California, but we've had droughts in Australia, and been able to see in that circumstance how it has affected them. Although it's, as John pointed out, it has a much bigger impact on the bulk wine market than it does on the Napa Valley fine wine market. But of course, the market, what he called the industrial production of wine, is a tremendously big business. And it's interesting that when we think of California wine, we think of Napa Valley, but actually I think Napa Valley produces about 5% of California's wine, and the other 95% comes from all the other places.
Central Valley, I guess, above all in that production scale.
Absolutely, absolutely. But of course, wine is sprouting out all over California and all over the United States.
Well, when you talk about Australian wine and the drought there, it starts to feel climate change. I mean, there are vineyards, many are right at the edge of the desert. That desert's moving.
That's absolutely right. When I visited Australia last year, about this time last year, it was clear that climate change was on everybody's mind. And as I speak around the world, it's kind of interesting. When I talk about climate change in the United States, I fall into the culture wars somehow. But when I'm anyplace else, it's a reality. So that if you look at where the changes are happening in Australia, and I think this may give a sense of what's happening in the rest of the world later on. Mm-hmm. In some of the main production areas, they're now trying to move away from the grapes that they have planted in the past and move toward more hot climate varieties. So that I see more Tempranillo, a Spanish variety, for example, in Australia. And the surge, the momentum in planting is actually in Tasmania.
Wow.
Which even after 50 more years of climate change will still be a cooler climate and have a greater ability to produce quality grapes.
Lots of things in motion here, including the climate and vineyards from maybe Australia to Tasmania. So far, so good in California on the drought front, though we'll talk more about that. And there are concerns there. Earlier this summer, here was California winemaker Ludovic Durvin. He owns Mum Napa. He was talking with Reuters about this year. He said because of the drought, the wine will be quite good, but he worries about the long-term effects of drought and maybe climate change.
You cannot go for forever if you never get water. You end up into desert conditions. We need a big rainy winter this year and for a few years in a row, actually, because in the long term, we're still in a drought.
Mike Viseth, you're an economist. I guess you should have a long view here. Does climate change move American wine production over time? What are people anticipating?
Oh, well, it's certainly going to change it. One of the scenarios, and there are different scenarios, and different regions are impacted differently. Greg Jones at Southern Oregon University is perhaps America's foremost viticultural climatologist, and his projections show that Napa is likely to be severely impacted by climate change. Oregon's wine region, not so much. And it will open some doors and it will shut others or change others. As I suggest, there are different ways to deal with the climate change, changing the grape varieties. There's one technique that actually alters the way that the vineyards are planted so that they shade themselves a bit more from the sun's heat, and that this can have an effect. But it will certainly change the nature of wine. And the scenario that I think is interesting is I think that it may make it uneconomic to produce as much of the inexpensive wines in the United States, and that there may be what I call part of a race to the top in American wine, where we'll import from other places the less expensive wines and focus more on making wonderful world-class fine wines.
We're looking at drought and quake and American wine and beyond. Antonio Galloni joins us in just a moment from Italy, big wine critic. But a couple of calls. Dennis in Las Vegas, Nevada. Dennis, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Tom, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What do you think? What do you see there?
The some of the things that you don't realize, I actually lived in Calistoga, California, which is the northern end of Napa Valley, home of Chateau Montelena that took home the gold in 1976 from the French, actually made wine with a small winery there in Calistoga, Laura Michael Wines in the North Valley. And a lot of hidden costs are affected by the quake this weekend.
Like what,
Dennis? The barrels that you see thrown all over the barrel rooms there, not only do we consider the wine, but those barrels, actually, if they are damaged, can sometimes run $2,000 or more per barrel.
Wow.
And, as the winemakers are preparing to prepare this year's vintage for the crush and what have you, they've gone through a lot of work to prep for that. And, crush is definitely on in the valley. It starts with what we call the green berries, the Chards, the Rieslings, those kind of things, and goes right on through till sometimes October. And there's a lot of effect that is being had there in the valley by not only the damage to the components of the winemaking, but also the disruption of day-to-day family and operations there in Napa.
Sure, as people knit things back together. Dennis in Las Vegas, I appreciate your call. Mike Viseth, stand by in Tacoma, Washington. I want to bring Antonio Galloni in right now, American wine critic, founder of the multimedia wine website Venus. The site's full of reviews and interactive maps and videos and lots of great wine information. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. He's former chief wine critic at Robert Parker's The Wine Advocate. He's on a tasting tour in Italy right now, joins us from Piedmont, Italy. Antonio Galloni, thank you very much for being with us.
Tom, thank you for having me on the show.
I assume you've been paying close attention to drought and just this last weekend, quake in California. Overall, let's just start with California. How's the wine business doing there? Wine production, Antonio?
Well, I would like to just start off by saying, obviously, we've been following the news very carefully and closely. Napa Valley, I spend maybe 6 weeks a year in Napa Valley. It's kind of become a second home.
Yeah.
People there have been extraordinarily gracious and kind to me, and I just want to send out a quick message to everybody who's listening to tell them that, you know, we're thinking about them continually and hoping that people can get through this challenge. It's, well, obviously a very difficult time. You wanted to talk about drought first, correct?
Yes, drought, quake, and California wine overall before we hit the rest of the country.
Well, drought, you know, as some of your previous guests talked about, 2012 was the first year of the current drought cycle. Yields were actually quite high. 2013, people expected yields to be lower in the second year of a drought cycle, but actually yields in 2013 or production is actually pretty generous. And what I saw in the spring of this year and the summer was a fairly healthy crop. We'll have to see sort of how things come in, as John Bonnet was talking about. It's just the beginning of the harvest right now. But it certainly looks like an average crop, and if it's not average, it's going to be slightly down, but not meaningfully far away from average. So I'd say in these 3 years, there's just as much a danger of surplus wine as opposed to lack of wine. You've got three average to above average crops, one right after the other. So I'm not really too concerned with production right now. You know, vines do have a memory. They're like people. They don't just reset every year. So there may be some longer term impact, but in the short term, I don't really expect to see too much of an impact on production.
Antonio Galloni, there's wet cultivation of wine, there's dry cultivation. As I understand it, Europeans do more dry cultivation. California has been more wet, that is, irrigated. Can that change?
Yeah, so that is one of the longer-term concerns, is there enough water to farm this crop? And, you know, it is true. In Europe, most of the classic wine regions that people think about, like Bordeaux, Burgundy, Piedmont, Tuscany, et cetera, those are all dry farmed. In other words, there's no irrigation at all. And in California, there are some vineyards that are dry farmed, but not, you know, it's much less common than irrigation. But, you know, there's a lot of very smart people spending a lot of time looking at this problem. And, you know, I'm very confident, highly confident that there'll be solutions to it. The one thing you cannot do is take a vine that has always gotten water and then just take it out. That would just be a complete shock. You know, you have to do things very gradually, very smartly, very intelligently. And so there may be a move to dry farming as water becomes scarcer. If that does indeed turn out to be a long-term trend, we'll see. But, you know, it's a big area of research. There's no doubt about it.
And Antonio, we're wishing the best, of course, for California here, but wine production, grape production and wine winemaking has just gone all over the country in recent decades. To take us on a little tour of the USA right now and where wine production is strongest and best.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not just the United States, it's you know, the world, but, you know, in the U.S.
Start with the USA, if you'd be kind enough.
Of course. Well, I mean, just looking at California alone, you know, we're talking about Napa Valley here, and, you know, on the subject of the earthquake, I mean, I think everybody's very lucky that this happened at 3 o'clock in the morning. You were talking about some of the pictures of the barrels that have toppled all over on top of each other. Well, if that had happened 6 hours later, while people were working, we'd be looking at a human cost here far in excess of what it is right now.
Because they were stacked very high, 200-plus injured, but no deaths as we speak. And yes, that is fortunate.
Nobody was working there.
Yeah.
Yeah, this happened at 3 o'clock in the morning. So if it had happened at 9 a.m., you would have had some severe injuries and probably casualties as well. But within California, we're seeing just this incredible explosion of places that are making just fantastic wine. I mean, in June, I was in Santa Barbara, and, you know, just beautiful wine after beautiful wine after beautiful wine. You know, so just, and that's a historic region for California. So
Pinot country.
More and more producers making wines there. And then you've got other places that are a little bit more smaller and nichier and marginal, like the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is, you know, there's more producers there making great wines. Paso Robles has a tradition of Cabernet Sauvignon and more recently Rhone varieties, also sort of older vine Zinfandels. There's just a tremendous amount of activity within California of more producers making greater wine, you know, better wines at all price points, from the inexpensive stuff you can afford to drink any day to the higher end stuff that we were just talking about a few minutes ago. So even within California, you have a tremendous amount of explosion of quality, which is, you know, great for the consumer. Probably never been a better time to be a wine consumer globally than right now, especially if you live in the United States. Then, of course, you look at Oregon and Washington, which are states that I, you know, those are wines that I drink for fun as opposed to for work. But, you know, the same thing is happening there. There's just more and more people making beautiful wines. And then that's before you look at smaller states like Arizona and Virginia, where there's much smaller industries. But even there, there's growth. So just within the United States, there's a, you know, a tremendous amount of explosion of interest and of planting of vineyards. One of the places that is getting some attention again is New York State. And it'll be interesting to see what happens there in cooler climate, Rieslings and things like that. So there's a lot to pay attention to just in the U.S.
And we've got big promoters and appreciators all over the place. Charles writes to us online, says, Eastern Washington. He says, Columbia River, Yakima River AVA, Walla Walla Valley AVA, Horse Heaven Hills, the other side of the Cascades, Washington, Oregon, expanding all over. Pete is calling from Nashville. Pete, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
My pleasure, Tom. Good to be here. Well, I'm a sommelier at a five-star hotel in Nashville, and let me preface this by saying I love California wine. I am from California.
Okay.
I support a lot of California wineries. But to me, this is just another chance to kind of tell the wine consumers out there that that it's a broad world of wine. People think Napa first because usually that's what they've tasted first, but it's not generally where I go for values.
Pete, where do you go for American wine? There's a whole world, and we'll look at it. But beyond Napa and California, as a sommelier, where do you turn?
Well, you know, in Tennessee, they make wine in every state. We make some wines here in Tennessee, and we do keep them on the list to satisfy the local desire for wine, although the quality around here, you know, hopefully no local winemakers are overhearing this, but it's not up to par with California. But some great wines coming from Virginia right now. A lot of people know Gruet, which is a fantastic sparkling wine made in New Mexico, of all places. So those are a couple domestic wines that, you know, that are not from kind of the traditional wine powerhouses of Napa and, I guess, Willamette Valley in Oregon for lighter wines. But those are some places, you know, within the U.S. that are making wine. It's a little bit spottier in terms of quality, but it's also really interesting.
Pete, our sommelier out of Nashville, we wish you luck with filling those cellars from all over, and I appreciate your call. Mike, where do you reach when it's beyond California? You're in Washington. Are you a Washington wine man?
I am a big fan. In fact, some of the people here say that it's because I study the global wine markets.
Yes.
They say, yes, Mike, that's fine that there's a global wine market, but why would you drink anything but Washington wine? And certainly it is interesting to see how this industry has developed. I know we'll have Drew Bledsoe on just a little later, and I just was tasting some of his wines in Walla Walla when I was there in June. And it's fantastic, and it is interesting. Walla Walla is a place where they're traditionally have irrigated, and they're working with dry farming there as well, and fantastic wines.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about California drought, Napa earthquake, and American wine, the big picture on wine in this country and beyond. Antonio Galloni joins us, big American wine critic. He is founder of the multimedia wine website Vinus, joins us from Piedmont, Italy today, where he's been testing and watching all the goings-on, quake, drought, and more in California, Napa. Mike Vseth is here from Tacoma, Washington, editor of the online journal The Wine Economist. We've got people appreciating wine all over the place. Charles says, I drink wines from all over the world, California wines among them, he writes to us online. I like Russian River Valley wines from Sonoma, Napa Cabs and Chardonnays, Gigert's Hills, Honig, Peju. I like wines from Monterey, from Washington State and Oregon, a pretty liberal palate there, all over the map. Drew Bledsoe, former NFL quarterback, joins us from Oregon in just a moment here. Pascal in Charlottesville, Virginia first. Pascal, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think?
Well, my go-to wines are my Virginia wines. I live in Charlottesville, and there are so many choices. I just want to stay local as much as possible.
Why, Pascal?
I think it's an environmental point of view, first of all, and they happen to be good wines. I like them. I'm French. I know French wines, and they're not quite as tremendous, but Virginia wines are great.
Wow, okay. A French import voting for Virginia wines, and we're happy to hear. Pascal, thanks for calling. Let's go to Drew Bledsoe right now in Bend, Oregon, former NFL quarterback with the New England Patriots, the Buffalo Bills, the Dallas Cowboys, owner of the Doubleback Vineyards in Washington State's Walla Walla Valley. Doubleback released its first Cabernet Sauvignon in 2007, and that wine made it onto Wine Spectator's 2010 Top 100 list. Drew Bledsoe, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tom. We're really excited about what's going on out here, man. First of all, thanks. Big thanks to Mike for his comments on our wine. That's awfully nice coming from him. And I do have to throw a quick plug in here. When Mr. Galone, the esteemed critic, says he drinks our wine for fun, man, that's a big feather in our cap. If he's drinking those wines for fun and not for work, we're taking that as high praise coming from a guy like Mr. Galone.
Vintner Drew Bledsoe, happy for the props there. What are you thinking as you've watched California's drought and the quake last weekend in Napa Valley, Drew?
Well, obviously, you know, our hearts go out to those that were affected by the quake. As Antonio was so correctly pointed out, we were really lucky that happened in the middle of the night, so we didn't have higher human costs. But it is, you know, it's heartbreaking when you see some of those really fine older vintage wines that I know were destroyed, and that those are works of art that people have curated so carefully over the years, and it's heartbreaking to see wines like that disappear without being enjoyed. Hopefully it sounds like they'll all pull together. The wine community is a pretty tight knit group. And while we are competitors in the industry, we also look out for each other. And I know that they'll pull together and find a way to get everything in the barn.
Drew Bledsoe, you heard our French American caller Pascal from Virginia saying she likes to drink local. How did you decide to go with a vineyard in Oregon? And, you know, it was for someone who's planted a flag there, how do you think about local versus drawing off this huge global market of many different nations supplying wine now, Drew?
Well, first of all, I'm a fan of wines from all over the world. You know, if you make wine, you always want to explore the entire world and see what's coming. You know, I'm fairly jealous of Mr. Galone being over there in Piedmont. You know, those are some of probably my very favorite wines are the Barolos and Barbarescos that come from Piedmont. Mm-hmm. But we're a big fan of what we're making here at home. Our winery is in the Walla Walla Valley. I grew up in Walla Walla. That's where I was born, or not born, but that's where I was raised.
Yeah.
And to be able to go back to my hometown and start a winery there in Walla Walla and to be a part of it, a new wine industry, is really exciting. You know, we're the beneficiary, honestly. Being a new wine region, one of the benefits you have is you get to piggyback on literally a millennia of wine knowledge. We're certainly very, it's continuing education. We're trying to practice the very best vineyard cultivation practices that we can find, and we get to piggyback on a lot of information as we're getting started. That's a great benefit to us. The other benefit that we have, just very quickly for your listenership, which I know is a very educated listenership, there are a couple of reasons that our particular region and our valley are really special. Mm-hmm. Number one, our latitude, if you wrap it around the earth, we bisect Bordeaux and Burgundy, get really long, hot summer days, very cool nights, and because we're inland and off the coast, our climate is very, very consistent year over year, so you don't get a lot of vintage variation from vintage to vintage. The other thing that's really exciting in Walla Walla, we've got this really amazing soil, and when I was growing up, in Walla Walla, that soil was used to grow sweet onions. So it was like Walla Walla and Vidalia
yes.
were the two places where you could get sweet onions. And that just wasn't very cool, Tom. I got to be honest, when you're growing up and you hang your hat on growing onions, it's not something to be real proud of. And thankfully, there were some pioneers that discovered that that deep, very mineral-rich, very porous soil was also great for growing world-class wine grapes. So it's a lot more fun to go home now, and you got a lot of wineries and the good restaurants that go with it and all of that. It's a lot cooler thing to hang your hat on than growing.
I like those sweet onions. But let me ask you, Drew, we're going to talk in just a second with Antonio Galloni and Mike Vizeth about the China market coming up. Are you watching that and other American vintners? Are you exporting to China? What about all the demand emerging there?
You know, we have not exported wine to China yet. We haven't needed to. I know that that's been a huge market, and it was a huge market, I know, at one point for First Growth Bordeaux. A lot of those First Growth Bordeaux wines were going to China. I think that maybe has slowed down a little bit, and that market has softened. But yeah, knowing some people that have spent a lot of time there, there's been an explosion in wine appreciation in China over the past couple decades. And now they're jumping in and starting to grow wine grapes, and so that's going to be interesting to see how that has, see what impact that has on the domestic wine market here in the United States. Whether they start making stuff that qualitatively is on par with what we're making here at home will be interesting to watch. But it's whenever you have a powerhouse like China come into any market, you got to be a little bit nervous about what that means.
Drew Bledsoe, owner of the Doubleback Vineyards in Washington State's Walla Walla Valley, former NFL quarterback. Drew, thank you very much for spending a minute with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on so much. Really appreciate it, Tom.
Great to have you. Good luck. Antonio Galloni in Italy, how do you look at China's emergence as a consumer and upcoming producer of wine, sir?
Well, I think it's going to be just really interesting to see how things play out. I mean, if you sort of look at it right now, just in the last year, the United States has become the global leader of wine consumption. So we now drink more wine than any other country in the world in aggregate. But the per capita consumption is still about a quarter of sort of old world Europe. So if you sort of want to look at that in just get an overview of what that means, you know, to put it into context, in the average French person will drink about 1.2 bottles of wine per week.
Okay.
The average American consumer will drink about one glass of wine per week. The average Chinese consumer will drink less than one bottle of wine in an entire year. So what you're looking at, what we've seen so far, is really just a drop in the bucket. If consumption there does start to increase in any really meaningful, sustainable, long-term way, it will have a profound impact on the demand for well-known, well-established wines from the United States, Europe, and anywhere else. And because of that, you're starting to see the development of vineyards in China and in India as well for the domestic market. So I think it's only a matter of time. There's just some, you know, Drew was alluding to this before about the role of science and technology and learning. I don't think there's any question that China and India and other countries will make good wine very soon. It's an open question as to whether they'll make a great wine. That nobody really knows. But there is a significant amount of investment in these countries to become producers of wine. And the track record of these countries is very, very strong. I wouldn't want to bet against them at all. I think it's just a matter of time before they start entering the market as very respectable producers in their own right. So you've got two ways of looking at that: their own consumption of existing wines, and then what is going to happen when China and other countries begin making very good wines on their own.
Let's go to New Orleans and Clifton. Clifton, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I just would like to speak to the issue of what wines are going to cost, and the drought and this earthquake in Napa are going to, I think, increase the prices of wine in those areas as production is affected, and maybe some vineyards become untenable due to lack of water. And yes, somebody's saying, oh, there might be a wine glut in several years, but I guess what, as a longtime wine consumer, mm-hmm. 40 years,
uh-huh.
My lament is that very good wine has become so expensive that no one really can develop a good palate, a good connoisseurship for fine wine. I was lucky that I could develop that back in the 70s when a lot of great wines were available for comparatively a pittance to what they are today. And I delight in the fact that the new president in China has sort of frowned on conspicuous consumption, and that's a downturn in the great wine consumption sales going on over there. I'm sure the people who make Chateau Aubillon delighted with that.
Clifton, you're breaking up a little bit on us there. I think there's probably plenty of conspicuous consumption there right now, but I'm so glad you raised this point. Mike Vesis, let me bring it to you. Price trends in wine, and Clifton's wondering what wines are going to cost with the different, with quake, with drought, with the trends we see, and I guess on top of that, what Americans are buying in terms of price tier.
Well, in terms of the prices of wine, you have to segment the market. America's and the world, and the world of wine is always complicated, and there's no single answer to most questions. But if you look at the very less expensive wines, sort of the $2 chuck class of wines, well, the cost of producing them is an important factor in how they're priced. But when you look at Napa Valley wines or fine wines, for example, it's really more about what people will pay as opposed to how much it costs to produce them. If you compare a $10 bottle of wine with a $100 bottle of wine, well, it's a 10 times difference in price, but it's not a 10 times difference in the cost of making it.
So are we seeing more people buying? Where's the buying target now for
Americans?
Sure.
In the United States, and to a certain extent in the major markets around the world, we're seeing a movement up to higher prices of wine. In the U.S. market, for example, in the last year, looking at the broad market, not just Napa Valley, but the broad market of everyday consumers, the overall wine market's been growing at a little more than 4% a year. But the fastest growing segment of that market is wines costing $20 and more, which has grown by about 15%. And in general, it's the higher quality wines where the growth is taking place, and the inexpensive wines, again, the $2 chuck, Franzia sort of wines, are actually declining somewhat in terms of the dollar value of sales.
And who's going to buy the great stuff? Well, here's Hong Kong-based wine critic Jeannie Cho Lee talking about Chinese wine drinkers, some billionaire wine drinkers, and where they turn their interests and appetites.
If a dozen mainland Chinese decided, I love this, this is what I want to collect, and decided to buy everything in the marketplace, I mean, very soon, it only takes a few people to corner the entire market for that particular wine from that particular vintage. So it's very easy to do, and that means for the rest of us, the prices are going to be astronomical. We're not going to be able to even afford a glass.
Jeannie Cho Lee talking about Chinese billionaire wine drinkers and their impact there. Christine in Buffalo, New York. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, we just came back from a wine tasting in the Niagara region of Ontario last Sunday, and there's a huge growth of wine makers, wine growers up there, and they actually talked a lot about the Chinese coming in. They're most famous for their very sweet ice wine, dessert wine that's, you know, harvested in the wintertime, and it was a really beautiful day. I had no idea how big the explosion of wine was up there.
And so much of it being shipped to China at this point. Antonio Galloni, where do you see the big enthusiasm right now for the best vintages coming out, for the most avid consumption these days, not just in volume, but people really into wine now?
Well, there's just interest at all different levels. I think that, you know, to sort of take a look at the previous question, the issue with the prices getting very high for certain wines is that people will not be able to afford those wines, and then as a consequence, consumers, but also sommeliers and people who work in the trade, won't have a reference point for what a first growth Bordeaux is or a Grand Cru Burgundy, because there is no wine and it's too expensive. However, at the same time, we've seen a tremendous growth in quality of wines that are in that $20 price range. There's a reason why that market is growing. It's growing because today's $20 wine is infinitely better than the equivalent wine would have been just 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So you've got a lot of different pockets of interest. And, you know, the these, you know, lesser expensive wines, maybe from not the United States, but from southern France or southern Italy, Greece, the southern hemisphere. Wines are absolutely delicious. You don't have to spend a lot of money to get a delicious bottle of wine today. And those $20-$25 wines are absolutely fantastic. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of pockets of growth. Sure, wealthy consumers have a very inelastic demand, and so therefore they will pay the prices for first growth Bordeaux or the high flying Napa Valley Cabernets or the great Barolos of the world, the great Grand Cru Burgundies. That those markets are pretty strong, but you know there's lots of different levels of places where there's activity as people become more global, people travel more, restaurants have better wines by the glass programs, people can be more adventurous, can taste. You know, all you have to do is ask somebody in this country who's 40 years old or so, 45 years old, and they'll tell you that when they were in college, the drink of choice was beer, and now it's in cocktails, and now it's very different. It's much broader. People want to know, they want to taste a Malbec or an Aglianico or Chardonnay or Pinot Noir. See, to me, it doesn't really matter. At Venice, we're pretty agnostic to what people like. We want to, you know, we want to cover the world of wine, and there's so much to cover in all of these different places because there's interesting things happening everywhere you look. I mean, your show is a perfect example. It's Finger Lakes, it's Canada, it's Arizona, it's New Mexico, it's Virginia. All of these places have stuff going on, and that's one of the things that just gets me super excited in the morning when I wake up because there's just so much happening everywhere. So I mean, we'd need like a 10-hour show to talk about.
We would, even on this side of Broken Barrels in Napa. Antonio Galloni with Venice, the website, joining us from Piedmont, Italy. Thank you so much. And Mike Vseth of The Wine Economist, our great thanks to you both. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Salute.